Also, willkommen zu
Okay,
dieser
welcome
Sternstunde. Schön, dass ihr alle so zahlreich hier seid.
To this late talk.
Das Universum so
The
groß,
universe
so weit und so unendlich schräg.
So infinitely strange, and Steini will tell us about it. Steini has been here estimated forever and has studied math and physics, but is not really a mathematician and physicist, but he can talk about the universe very well. So, and we are happy to have him here. Sit back and open your ears, and a very warm welcome for Steini, please.
Yeah, wow, vielen Dank.
Hallo. Hello, thank you. Lots of people. I'm impressed. I thought it would only be 20 or 30. Okay. So the universe, quantum physics, and I want to take you along on a journey, first into the past, maybe into the past of science, the history of science, of physics, because if you try to tell laypersons and absolute beginners, talk to them about quantum physics, then we need a bit some foundation, and we need to know how science works. Long time ago, Aristotle and physics at the time, and science philosophy was mostly the same. The universe contained of fire, water, earth, and wondered about what is light, and we talk about quantums, then we talk about light quantums, and light is very elementary in this. The old Greek thought the light came out of the eye, so we talk about the light of the eye, and so the eye is light of the world, and so people can see, and so it's infinitely fast. So if you close your eyes and open them again, everything is visible again, so no time is passing, so light is infinitely fast, okay? And quite a long time this view prevailed, but there were critics, but there was no really a scientific method for verifiable theories and things like that, and in medieval times it wasn't a lot better. The church tried to prevent things that could have opened the eyes of people. So now we are around 1672. Ole Rømer, a Danish astronomer, Galileo had built telescopes. And was a dealer in telescopes, and Ole Rømer tried to solve the problem of time. And how can you measure time precisely if you're not a clock, not a very, very precise clock? So, and he wasn't the first to do that. And what he did was look at the planets. And at a time where people knew or should have known, although some people denied it, that the Earth is a sphere and circles around the Sun, and there are other planets also circling there. And he looked at Jupiter's moons, how Jupiter's moons circled around Jupiter, and it's a very precise clock. And if you could understand exactly how that works, you had very precise clocks, and you could know where you are on Earth if you have a very precise clocks. And he made a table and wrote down when these moons disappeared behind Jupiter, and in this table, for many moons, he made these tables, and depending on the season on Earth, those figures differ. And he thought about it and found that there was a rhythmic difference, and it was in summer, it was different from winter or spring or summer, but the next summer it was the same as the summer before, so it has to do something with the Earth circling around the Sun. And then found out that this couldn't be possible, that light was infinitely fast, and he couldn't explain it differently except by a finite speed of light. And so if we were longer away, farther away from Jupiter, the light takes longer. And when we're closer to Jupiter, the light doesn't take as long. And in science, it's very important he made a prediction for a specific date at which time the moon would disappear behind Jupiter. And it was a 10-minute difference from his table, because he knew the speed of light is infinite, and this prediction came true. And there was something that was very valuable in science, because the theory that he had was not very bad. So he did something very well. He showed that the speed of light is finite. And there's something about light with quantums. And why do I talk about this? Because science works very well if you can observe something, and from this observation you can make a hypothesis. And if you then make a theory from that, make a mathematical description of that, and from this mathematical description can make a prediction and can come up with an experiment and perform this experiment, and then my prediction comes true. And then in science, in physics, I have really achieved something. Then we jump forward a few hundred years, 1856, 59, or in the 70s, Max Planck studied physics, and people said, oh, no, don't do that. His father said, don't do that. If you study physics, you can't become anything. Nothing will come of you. But he still did, and some things were still strange, and he looked into that, and he wasn't the first, and he found that strange, and he looked at black body radiation. And how do black bodies radiate? How do they emit light? When they get hot, they are black because they don't reflect light, and whatever they light comes from them is their own radiation. And it's quite difficult. 1895, to make a black body is very hard. He made a box and made a hole in it, and so it's black, and looked at the color of the hole if he heated up this box, and he looked how the color of this light agreed with classical physics of the time. And what was called a measuring error wasn't right, and the prediction was very strange, because the prediction said the more energy I put into it, the shorter the wavelength becomes from the light, and that at some time would need to lead to it becoming yellow and blue and ultraviolet, and the box would disappear then at some time. But the box doesn't disappear. Well, this was called then the ultraviolet catastrophe. And this mathematical theory behind this physics people had thought of wasn't right. And then he looked into it and he researched it and thought it was worthwhile. But shit, it doesn't really work. And he called it the act of ultimate desperation. And he introduced a constant just out of thin air, not quite out of thin air. We don't talk about the details, otherwise we wouldn't finish today. He introduced a constant and called it H, the active quantum, and that led to the energy not being transmitted continuously, but in packets. And this packet-wise transfer of energy, so not continuously increasing, but in different packets in this equation, led to the equation making very good predictions and predicting something that could actually be measured. And many years he worried about that, he was angry about that, because he really wanted to save the old physics that he liked. And this was just an emergency. In desperation, he invented this quantum. And into the 1920s, he tried to get rid of it. Because he found that it actually made sense was Albert Einstein. And 1904 or 1905, he thought, damned, Max Planck is right. And it isn't just, it's really all energy is quantized and only comes around in in little packets. There's no half light packet. There's not 3/4 or 2 1/7 light packets. There are only whole light packets, 1 or 2 or 4 or 8 or 6, and they transport a specific amount of energy depending on their frequency. And he could prove that by the photoelectric effect. And what many people don't know, it was for that and only for that he won the Nobel Prize, and not for E equals mc squared or general relativity or anything like that, but for that, for the photoelectric effect. And now let's think at what time we were. 1905, the existence of the atom was a hypothesis. It was the atomic hypothesis, and it wasn't quite clear. And you have to imagine the leap of faith, where the universe was just a single galaxy. Everything you could see was just one galaxy, and people thought there was nothing outside the galaxy. And atoms, well, yeah, was just, well, we can talk about that. But, and he only received the Nobel Prize in the 1920s, when it became clear that he was damn right.
Right, so we have Albert Einstein, and together with these thoughts of Planck, he discovered quantum physics and developed quantum mechanics. There were other people who added themselves to this roster. Well, Einstein was sitting in a car with a young physicist called Werner Heisenberg, who told him about his uncertainty relationship, and suddenly Einstein became an old classic physicist and said, well, that's completely random, that's crap. It's obvious, everything is clear, it's not one or the other. What does it mean, uncertainty principle? Well, Heisenberg had the following thought. Well, I can't, given a certain quantum, he developed the maths around it using matrix mechanics, which worked quite well, but everyone thought it was crap. Well, Einstein also didn't think it was that awesome, but it predicted the following. Given a quantum, I can either know exactly the position, or I can know exactly what direction and with what speed it moves. And I'm not, this is the prediction, not because I'm not able to measure, but it's inherently impossible. And this is where it gets bizarre. It's fundamentally impossible. If you nail a particle down, you cannot say what energy it has, and so long as I know exactly where it is. And this, the consequences are, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens as a consequence. And Einstein thought it was quite annoying. So then came along Erwin Schrödinger and tried to save it, and who thought of the Schrödinger equation, a nice wave representation of this particle-based physics. So we're moving towards the dilemma of the wave. What is light? Well, we know it has a speed, but is it a wave or is it a particle? Is it a quantum, just like quantum physics, the new fancy quantum physics, or is it a wave, as is might be obvious? Well, Schrödinger came up with a wave equation, which worked very well, exceptionally well. So there are now two systems that work very well, the matrix mechanics and the wave Schrödinger's equation. Max Planck thought the wave equation a lot more elegant, but it led to some very bizarre theories. We have to think that this is all theoretical. So these were all theoretical thoughts. They had very little direct experimental research. They just tried to do the thought experiments. And you can only do this if you understand it and try and write it down in a mathematical form. The science is pointless if you don't have a working mathematical model. So now we have the following phenomenon. Right, we need to find out, is it a wave, is it a particle? So someone suggested, you've all heard this, the two-slit experiment. It works as follows. I shoot some light through two slits, which are very close to each other, hoping that, so, well, okay, lights the waves, it meets this slit, and behind the slit it propagates like a wave. And because I have two slits, and because the two waves, let's just imagine putting through stones in, and they interfere coherently or incoherently. And then I have a screen so I can see an interference pattern, which is a funny pattern, just like if you imagine having a wave hitting a wall and leaving some color traces. All right, said as they said, they did it. And all right, there we go. Well, there was still the quantum physics in the room. Well, light is a particle, so you can think of the interesting experiment which they couldn't actually think of at the time. All right, let's try. Which of the slits did it actually use? I'm going to use a detector, which spots quanta. It spots quanta, light quanta, or electromagnetic particle. You could also use an electron. And as soon as I look, it stops doing it. As soon as I look, which of the slits does the light go through, it no longer behaves as a wave. And that's pretty weird, isn't it? Well, how does the light know that I'm looking? That's even weirder. We could talk about this for hours, how you determine this. You have to believe a few things. I want to fascinate you so that you can look into yourself. So what you can demonstrate is that if this particle passes through this double slit, then it's not that if I don't look, it goes through one, and then if you use a different particle, it uses the other slit, which is somehow also a wave, and it interacts. But actually, it passes through both one and the other at the same time. Well, unfortunately, you have to believe me here. We can't demonstrate this here experimentally, but you can diminish the source of light so much that only individual photons are emitted, and you can detect them. You just put a screen somewhere, and it emits a pling if there's a photon, and so you can see that it has been emitted. All right, so I'm going to put this double slit there. So I'm going to shoot a single photon in that direction, and on the other side, it hits the wall, but not as if it had gone through a single slit, but in the same way, in the way as if it interfered with itself. And you can demonstrate. It's possible. It's a complicated proof, but it is possible. In the final form, is only proved in 1999 that we can prove that this particle passes both through one slit and also the other at the same time. That it also took every single other possible path that there was. So long as I don't look. Right, and it gets worse. It's not just... all right, so we have to go back a bit. So the Schrödinger equation says, predicts, and this is where Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr also... So Niels Bohr is a famous person based on the Bohr atom of the model. If you learn that electrons are orbiting in the core, it's a complete nonsense. Makes absolutely no sense. I got very annoyed by this in the school because the teacher couldn't explain. So the core is positive, the electrons are negative, they're orbiting. There are several electrons that are orbiting. They're negative, so they repel. How could they possibly orbit around the core in several shells? How is that possible? It's not possible. That's only for demonstration purposes. This is the problem with quantum physics. You can't. It's not very. You can't really look at it, and not at all. It doesn't mesh with our practical sense of how the world works. So as promised, it's going to get more bizarre. So I can do an experiment which is suggested by the Schrödinger equation. It predicts if you can interact with two particles together, so that they behave just like a single particle. And the equation says, it doesn't say where the particle is. It says there's only probabilities. It only says there's a certain probability that the particle will be here or there if you look. That's the important point. Only if I check, if I observe. If I don't observe, it's everywhere at the same time, but with a higher probability over here. Well, given these two particles, that's a bit weird. So how there's behavior as a single particle, but these two particles can be measured at two places at the same time because they're two particles, but they do depend on each other. They are, in some sense, a single particle. They are subdividing the information. So, all right, let's go back a bit. If a half semi-transparent mirror, light passes through it, about half of it. All right, I shoot a photon at it, and there's a certain probability that the photon will pass through, and there's some probability it won't. And this probability is exactly 50%, because it's semi-transparent, obvious. Well, there's no reason for this. And this is an important, very important fact of quantum mechanics. There is baseless randomness. Which is bizarre. Well, normally you could say, and this is what Albert Einstein said for a very long time, that God does not roll dice. There's no baseless randomness. I just don't know everything. If I throw up a coin and I get a random result, well, if I knew everything, the air resistance, speed, etc., I would be able to predict what side will be up. But given this quantum, I cannot predict. And I can prove, there is a proof that proves that I cannot know whether it's going to go through or not. It's a completely random and baseless randomness. All right, so I have two of these particles, which I generate using a photon. You don't need to care how I generate it. Okay, all right, so I'm going to create these two interlock particles. All right, it goes in two directions. So in this direction, I observe, as you can, has it gone through the mirror or not? All right, I have done it over here, If I do that, it will do the exact same thing on the other side, even though it's completely random. How does a particle over there know that the other particle has gone through? And that's one of the key questions of quantum mechanics. Nobody can answer this question to this day. It gets even more bizarre. I can, and you can check this on Google, I can do the delayed quantum eraser experiment, with which I can demonstrate that this property is also applicable reverse in time. It's a very complicated experiment. I'm not going to explain this. I'm just doing the usual trick that people do. I mean, I explained this using coins. All right, normally I throw up a coin and I put it on the desk. It's either head or tails, and do it on the other side as well. They're completely independent. All right, if I have two interlocked ones, and if I throw both of them up and grab both of them out, and if I look on one side, I have head, then I have head on the other side as well, guaranteed. All right, now we get to the quantum eraser, with which you can demonstrate it is reversible in time. All right, I'm going to throw coins up in time. I'm going to take the one and put it down on the table. The one on the table has already decided whether it's heads or tails. All right, now I'm going to take this quantum for a loop. All right, now I check the one that's in the air. Is it a number or is it head or tails? All right, you understood. They're both tails. This is what quantum interference is. This is what Einstein called the spooky long distance effect. These are the two things where Einstein was like, "What the fuck? What do you mean complete randomness? That's crazy. That can't be." God doesn't roll dice, and the spooky long distance effect, he wouldn't have anything to do with it because it has a consequence, which is that we have to say goodbye to our previous view of the world completely. At the core, the world is set up in the following way. I don't know where a particle is so long as I don't look, it's not just because I don't know because I don't know. Because I'm not looking, because it's because it hasn't decided. Well, it sounds banal, but just imagine there's a radioactive particle. This radioactive particle is going through space, and now it's simultaneously in the state, it's already decayed, it's already a different particle. So no longer uranium, but whatever. No idea. I'm not an atomic a nuclear physicist. Maybe some electron, an alpha particle. What? Anyway, it's both uranium atom, but at the same time something else. So long as no one's looking, so this particle's coming towards me. So long as I haven't looked at the particle, as I haven't observed it, I can't tell. Not just because I'm not able to, because I'm not looking there, which is obvious because I can't see, but just it's fundamentally impossible because it has not been decided yet. And due to this, it's not obvious if the moon is there even if someone isn't looking.
Kein Scherz.
That's not a joke. Or the question which was posed back then, wouldn't somebody have to look at the moon all the time to make sure it's there? Now we get to the core of the matter and at the same time change the theme to cosmology, which is closely related. The core of the matter. What exactly does it mean to look at something? What is the measurement? When does the collapse of the wave function happen? When does the wave function collapse? And that's the bizarre thing. This happens with super light speed. In one instant, if you watch the particle, and it goes through the mirror at the other end, at the same time. This information, which cannot be exchanged, because we know since Einstein that it can't travel faster than light. Somehow these two particles know of each other, and the superposition collapses at the time, at the instant that I look at this. And so if I've seen it here, it goes away over there. And if I didn't, then it does appear there. But before I did it, it was at both places at the same time. As long as nobody's looking, it can be anywhere at all. We don't know. It's not just that we don't know, it is everywhere at the same time. It only appears at one place if I look with a certain probability. And the tunnel effect, which you may have heard of, you know, if quants tunnel through an isolator, there's a certain probability that they arrive at the other side because the wave function sort of smears through the isolator. And that is the basis of quantum physics. I can measure these effects. I can check this. You can check with Google. Take a look at the Bell equation. I can prove that the information isn't there from the beginning. Like, it was already clear when these photons were born. No, it's random. It is decided the moment that I look at the photons. And the heart of the matter is, what does it mean to take a measurement?
Und damit ist klar, was passiert ist, oder ist eine Messung erst, weil die Messgerät selber könnte ja in einem Überlagungszustand zwischen gemessen und nicht gemessen sein.
Is it a measurement that takes
So this is a question we don't really know what the measurement is and how it influences it, and we really don't know, and that's what makes quantum physics so fascinating. It is absolutely not clear if it is necessary that there is awareness to looking at the measurement, and nobody really knows, without any doubt. So there's a reason to believe that it can be done without awareness, but there is no proof, and this is just, they're just guesses and some equations that lead us in that direction, but we don't really know that. But Erwin Schrödinger said that the total amount of awareness in the universe is exactly one. And maybe he was talking about himself, so because he cannot say anything about anything else. Well, so let's get to the other part of this talk, and that is cosmology. So what does this have to do with cosmology? And it has to do with it that we have to go back a bit further in the 1920s, 1925, around there. Edwin Hubble had a huge telescope and looking into the world and found out, maybe it was a bit earlier, and he found that, whoa, there are more than one galaxy, and because he could see others with a good telescope, and he could something else, which really destroyed the old image of the world, that there was only one galaxy. He could see more galaxies, but he could see something more by looking at exploding supernovae, 1A type supernovae. They make a very specific image, very, very bright in a very typical profile. They have this eruption of brightness. It is as bright as the center of a galaxy. It is as bright as billions of suns. And this is the type 1A supernova. And one can use that to look, to say how bright is it really, and look at how fast is it moving. This is a redshift. It is not Doppler. It is a relativistic effect, but we can see, look at the supernova and then see how fast the galaxy is moving away from us. And he found that all of them are moving away from us. And that is strange, and it's really strange, because it shows that earlier they were closer together, and even earlier they were closer together. And you can calculate back, and current calculations have found out that a long time ago, I wrote it in the introduction, they were at a single point. It's such a bizarre thing as a point of a size of the quantum length. It is 10 to the power of minus 34, 35. It is the smallest length that we can talk about in physics, really. For everything smaller, particles would become black holes, so that would be smaller at all smaller scales, so we cannot really apply our physics on these small scales. It doesn't really matter, but all the universe was, well, we just can't talk about it, we can't say anything about it, so physicists will just shrug and say, we don't know, we can't say anything. Physicists never say why, but he says how, and works, and that's the philosophers then say why it works, and the physicists just say, well, just calculate it. And Einstein said it has to be real, and that's really the problem. We have to go back to quantum physics,
and we need to use one of both concepts. Do things have one definite position? In that case, we have to accept that they don't have impulse, or do they not have position? Then, so somehow this concept of time and space is strange. It doesn't work. This concept seems relusion. It isn't.
It's not really in these dimensions. It's not then somehow not really real. And we're going back to cosmology, and we look back to the beginning of the universe and all the universe, and we get a better understanding of this if we find that particles consist of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and protons and neutrons consist of quarks. And as far as we know, quarks have no size. Shit. So, and then there's the string theorist. Well, yeah, but very, very small. It's just a string, which isn't really interesting, according to the what I call the classical quantum mechanics. After what we know today, the not string theory, quarks do not have any size. They're simply energy, and so everything you consist of is pure energy. They are standing waves and wobbling around, but really don't have any size, though they're vibrating energy, but no size. A proton has a mass, and you can measure that. It's quite complicated, but you can read about it, how that is done, and you find that three quarks have an energy and somehow some sort of mass and a resting mass, and it doesn't equate to the mass of the proton. The three quarks, they only make up 3% of the mass of the proton, and the rest of the mass comes from the energy of wobbling back and forth, and And the quantum fluctuations, what is quantum fluctuation? It's a very bizarre construct of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. If only it goes fast enough below the Planck time, is the time that light you needs to pass a Planck length, 10 to the minus 34th, is very, very short, but below this time, the physics doesn't work, and you can violate the physics, and you can violate the law of conservation of energy and everything that is holy in physics. And below Planck time, everything can happen spontaneous, as much energy can be created, always two, always two and a part and its anti-part. They just have to disappear fast enough, and then the physics isn't violated, then everything is zero in the sum total. So the theoretical physicist is happy, and
everything hunky-dory, everything clean. Now, if this happens all the time, though, and it does happen all the time, then energy comes from nothing and it goes back to nothing, and this energy, this virtual energy, actually increases the mass or contributes to the mass of the photon. And let's imagine, you know, that all matter that you know consists of small parts of nothing really, or maybe strings if you believe in string theory. So now it's clear that all of matter isn't actually matter. It's really, like Einstein said, E equals mc squared, it's really energy. So all this is condensed in a very, very small room that you can't even imagine. It's like a billionth of a meter. All this energy fits in there because it consists of like nothing. And the idea, which hasn't been proven, but the idea of the origin of the universe is that all this energy, the entire universe could be spawned from a quantum fluctuation. It's a bit hard to imagine that this this room expanded like an explosion so quickly, and this is actually doesn't fit with relativity theory. It expanded faster than light. Well, it's really the space between particle that grew so quickly that they got distant but quicker than light. That's the cosmic inflation, which you may have heard of. So just recently somebody said, we have found cosmic inflation. Looking at the background radiation, you can go look back in time. The universe is 13.8 billions of years old. And we can look back in time up until the point where it was about 300,000 years old. That was the point in time when the universe became transparent. Before that, everything was a big plasma and really opaque. Whether it's 100,000 or 300,000 years, nobody knows quite for sure. But that's when it became transparent. And we now see the background radiation. These are areas of variations in temperature of the background. These variations of brightness that we see is the reason for planets, stars, galaxies forming. Otherwise, everything would have been the same and homogeneous everywhere. But if today's physics is right, then the quantum fluctuation of space at the very beginning of the universe is what makes stars and planets today. And then stars explode, and the laws of physics are built. So the origin of the universe may have its origins in quantum mechanics. And the BSEPT 2 experiment has tried to prove the following. They showed that this cosmic inflation, which so far has only a theory, that something should have happened, which is gravitational waves, so-called gravitational waves. Let's imagine sun disappears from one day to the other,
dann wäre also die Sonne pff, einfach weg. Dann würde jetzt
so if sun just went away, room space is warped because of the gravitation, and this warp then travels like a wave. It would sort of make the space become larger and smaller around us. You could see that, you can measure that by looking at the polarization of the background radiation. They tried it, they didn't succeed, they didn't put the correction factor in that is needed for the dust that is in the universe.
Planck-Experiment vom Planck-Satelliten abfotografiert, weil das
they
noch
took
nicht
that down from a PowerPoint presentation about the Planck satellite instead of copying directly and it didn't quite take the exact value and so there's an 8% chance that they are actually wrong in one of the most important experiments of our time that's just not precise enough and we can't just say 8% no that's nothing. Because it would prove inflation, but it hasn't. 8%, that is too much. So we continue to research this. You can look forward to if we can prove the cosmic inflation with such an experiment, then that also means that the Big Bang has happened or has been caused by a quantum fluctuation. So it still makes sense to become quantum physicist or a cosmologist because there's still the question what's outside either or what's inside the Planck length. There's so many different stories and themes that we can't even touch because it would take too long. But if this experiment would succeed. That would mean A, the universe came about from a quantum fluctuation. B, it is very probable that there's more than one universe, there's many universes with many different types of physics. I mean, what could be more bizarre than the fact that it's just us that is here? There could be two possibilities. Either, there's a God-like entity somewhere, the Joe God, or just by pure randomness. Maybe all of the time, permanently, new universes are spawned.
Yeah, so there were so many universes only in the one in which we are here. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing it if in a universe where we are not there. So now we could talk about the Higgs boson. No, we can't do that within 1 hour. But if you like, we could talk about this again tomorrow, perhaps. See if you can find me, and then we can talk about it some more. But this really isn't just hypothetical. It is very, very close. As far as we know, the universe somehow, nobody knows why, there are new theories, superstrings and supersymmetry and N-theory, and it's really fun to read and to look it up. It's really complicated. The universe somehow was very, 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 very small, smaller than anything you can imagine. All energy, all matter, everything was in there, and then it expanded very fast. And we still forgot about dark energy and dark matter, and because we can measure that, it's not just we don't know. Let's just call it dark, but it's really there. And spiral galaxies are turning much faster than they should. If all the matter that we can see was all the matter that there is. And you can measure very exactly that there must be more matter there that we cannot see. And we can measure very precisely that galaxies far away, move away from us much faster than they should when the universe was expanding constantly or even decelerating. But in fact, it is accelerating, so there must be some other energy driving the universe apart. And nobody really knows what it is, but dark matter and dark energy. So dark means we don't know, but we just see it's there. We can see its effects. This dark matter and this dark energy make about 95 or 98% of the total energy of the universe. So what we see, all the energy of the stars, the planets, all of us, only make really, really nothing. We're totally irrelevant in this energy structure of the entire universe. But we can see that it is there all of these energies, if we add all of these energies and the universe, that the universe is totally flat, so that there is no curvature in the universe, outside or inside, but it is totally flat. And if we add up all these energies, the positive and those expanding, driving the universe apart and collapsing the universe, and the sum total of that is completely zero, is exactly zero. And there's an indication here that the universe, as we see it here, with all the physical properties, could really have come from nothing, because, as far as we know, there's the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg, and so there was the possibility that all of this possible reality was there, in which it could happen. And so at this point in time, there was no time, so there was no time limit for testing it. So looking backwards, you could say it was this entire universe came from a gigantic superposition because it could, just out of nothing, from absolute nothing. And there is no cause for that. And so I want to get to the end and allow some questions. I know it was a lot in a short time. I asked for 3 hours, but well.
Super.
Yeah, super. You talked so fast. I brought you some water.
So, hat denn jemand Fragen?
Are there any questions? Please move up to the microphones.
Und die Leute, die jetzt gehen, bitte ganz leise durch die vordere Tür. Oh ja, fangen wir mal da drüben an. Auf der, das ist jetzt unsere rechte Seite 1, bitte.
Ja, hi. Erstmal danke für den Vortrag.
I thank you much for the talk.
Du hattest von den Quantenfluktuationen gesprochen.
You spoke about quantum fluctuations. And it seemed a bit random, like any old quantum fluctuations could happen. Or anything would be probable. So I'd be interested in how far is it the actual measurement of the quantum fluctuation, which you may have happened. Whether the measurement determines the quantum fluctuations.
Well, the problem is with measuring the quantum fluctuation, it's not easy to measure. There's an effect known, predicted by a certain Casimir, that's why it's known as the Casimir effect, where we assume that if you put two very planes, metallic planes next to each other and bring them close to each other, then there will be the quantum physics says that particles can only be created in a space only whole particles can be created. So between the particle plates, could only such particles can be generated that are completely or duplicate or three times or fit multiple times, but not ones that fit half or two thirds of the time. Which means that between these plates, different particles than outside could be generated. Which is why, therefore, the two plates should be pressured towards each other, because there should be an interference between the outside and the inside. And you can measure this force. I'm not 100% sure if nowadays it's accepted generally that this force really has to do with the postulated quantum fluctuations, the cosmic fluctuations. But what you can do is you can predict them mathematically. And mathematically, it is possible to predict, as far as I know, like I'm not a quantum physicist or cosmologist, but as far as I know, arbitrary particles could be generated or destroyed. This is also a cause of one of these Hawkins radiation. So if one of these particles generated at the limit of the event horizon and one bit goes into the event horizon, into the black hole, and the other bit goes outside, which leads to the fact that there's a particle inside the black hole and that the particle is outside. So which leads to the fact that all black holes will disappear eventually if they don't get new food. Well, to answer your question, so long as you don't look, these particles are both in the state of having been created and not having been created, which you call it something like the zero-point energy, which all these physicists try to use very faithfully try to use, which they keep using, but it doesn't really work with some foils or aluminium. No, it doesn't really work. Well, I think this fluctuation can take any possible state that is possible, so long as you're not observing.
Okay, danke schön. Wir nehmen, ich gehe einfach mal der Reihe durch. Auf der rechten Seite Mikrofon 2, bitte.
Seht das?
Ja.
My question is, I've heard once that you can either determine the position or you can determine the speed, and that the other one is unsharp. So in theory, you could tell the police that you wouldn't know I've been here, because if you measure my speed so quickly, then how do you know I'm there?
Well, in principle, that is correct. If you were a photon, that would be exactly correct. But that's why this is an unresolved question. Are these quantum effects apply to everything? So the bigger you are, the more energy would be needed to measure it. At some point, trying to measure it, you generate more particles, which is also a bit of the problem that the LHC has. The Large Hadron Collider. So you can't separate two quarks, because this costs so much energy. So the more you separate them, the larger the energy the holding them together becomes. At some point, you have to employ so much energy to separate them that you generate a new quark. So immediately they're together again. So you can't separate them, which is kind of the same thing with that thought you just had. With a macroscopic object also has this object, but it's so tiny that it's not measurable.
Oh, that's a pity.
Yeah, well.
Und dann eine Frage vom Internet, bitte.
This is a question from the Internet. Yes, the net had a lot of fun. So, the tail end of this other question. State it supervises us all. So we now have to turn into quants, so observe us.
That's nonsense. In some sense, we're only here because they're observing us.
Can we have a real question?
Well, that's completely legitimate.
On holographic universe and simulation thereof, how can we tell whether we're in a simulation or not?
That's a tough question. You could talk about this for another hour. There is quantum information. There are quantum information theorists who believe that they can prove that this is the case. They say, which is what Dalai Lama also has struggling with, this random. Well, if it indeed can be proven that the random But they have to change the doctrine. Well, the quantum information theory is they're a very open-handed religion in quotation marks. The idea that to change his doctrine based on research is pretty open, I think, by the way. Well, there is a part of quantum information theory which says, actually, you know, it's different. Well, you yourself are also quantum mechanical states. So the quantum that arrive are somehow interfere with the ones the electrons in our eye, which once again is an infinite chain of interference up into our brain. And in reality, nothing is being decided. So the whole so-called collapse, the so-called decoherence, it does never actually happens. Both happens actually. So why does someone decide to see one? Does someone decide to see one thing but not the other thing? Which means the quintessential part of this piece of quantum information theory is everything is an illusion. But was ist illusioniert? Also who is the public? Who's watching this? Who's the spectator of this virtual reality? It cannot be answered right now, this whole question. There are theories as to how to answer it. They exist, but I think they're all nonsense.
George says that an experiment has been made and the result is we're not living in a simulation. Very clear. This is about hologram.
Well, the holographic universe is talking about is a different thing. Is one thing is simulation, the other thing is the holographic museum. It's quite universe is quite slightly different. It's slightly confused. It got slightly confused. There is a thing I don't quite understand, so I don't quite dare talk about it. But people do claim to prove that we are not living in the holographic universe.
Okay. Also, danke für den Vortrag.
Thank you very much for the talk.
Dass du auch zumindest teilweise ein bisschen angesprochen hast, dass es durchaus, teilweise ein bisschen schwierig zu verstehen.
As you said, it's some of these things are hard to understand. They don't seem logic at all, like the quantum mechanics. The problem I have with standard model physics in general is it gets difficult when you look in general. If you look at redshift as a Doppler effect, the redshift is a linear effect, linear in the rate of variation. But you can show that it's actually not a linear effect at all, but there's a periodicity of 34 kilometers. And you can show that the Feinstoff constante has been coded in there. There's other things, like globally clusters. I'll show you afterwards. I'll show you the proof and the paper. People who published this, you have to look in the details. And the details don't fit. They don't match. There's theoretical things that have been measured. They've been referenced. The paper has
been. Can I just check? Have you derived the Schrödinger equation? Well,
so I haven't actually personally.
Well, if personally people, derived the Schrödinger equation. If you don't understand what people understand without, I think it's a shame that a lot of people spend a lot of time to talk about theories that are so random without spending time to look at and understand what has currently been done.
Yes.
It's not that physics is suddenly new. Well, people always say quantum physics has proven that everything could be different. It's not quite the same. Also, the relativity doesn't do that. They're always just more refinements of the existing problems, and they solve problems with the existing. Just the thing I want to say, the redshift is not a Doppler effect.
But it's the galaxies.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can discuss this afterwards in the Congress for hours, starting tomorrow.
Der rechten Seite Mikrofon 1 bitte.
Wie wahrscheinlich oder was hältst du von der
Theorie? What do you think about the theory of supersymmetry?
Well, supersymmetry is a very interesting topic.
Ich stehe so ein bisschen mit der ganzen Stringtheorie auf Krieg.
I don't quite get along with the string theory. It's very random, I thought. I do see his attraction. There are some pretty cool, there's some weird mathematical hacks which I don't quite like. Amongst other things, just to mention a few random ones. String theory works because in a certain type of mathematics, the sum of all natural numbers between 1 and from 1 to infinity is minus a 12th. You can derive it. It's just a bit fishy as far as I think. It explains a few things very well, but to this date, there is not a single piece of evidence. If it would work more elegantly mathematically if every particle had a symmetrical particle. So for every fermion, a gluon, a fermion, and for every gluon, a gluon. So if there was a mirror symmetry between that everything would work a lot better.
I have to stop here. We're running out of time, and of course we could talk about this for hours. Please meet tomorrow and give a round of applause for Steini. Thank you very much.